Welcome back for this session of Vayhi, or the miracle of the Jews getting their homeland restored after hundreds of years of not having national sovereignty. When we left off in our last session, we were talking about what the Bible calls the persecution before the persecution. And that first big persecution that did make it into the Bible in Ezekiel 20 and Ezekiel 22 is the Nazi Holocaust from the 1930s and 40s. Now, what we saw in our last session was Adolf Hitler coming to power as Germany's chancellor in 1933 under Hindenburg, the president. Well, Hindenburg died, and Adolf Hitler assumed complete control of the government. Well, he immediately started violating the Versailles Treaty and conducted a whole host of activities to rearm Germany. Now, the German rearmament program really did lead to full employment. And there was just an unrestrained expansion of production of war materials. And this was reinforced by Hitler's foreign policy successes. He threatened people and he intimidated them. Now, the Rome-Berlin Pact of 1936, the Anschluss with Austria, and the so-called liberation of the Sudeten Germans in 1938, which is really just him occupying that region, it brought Hitler to the height of his popularity. You know, in 1938, I believe it was February, he dismissed 16 senior generals, and he took personal command of the armed forces. So he ensured that he had total control of the military for implementing his own agenda. Believe this or not, the same year, Time magazine named him Man of the Year. In 1939, the Nazi Blitzkrieg, as it's called, war, marched into Poland on September the 1st, and the Gestapo and the SS followed quickly after that, setting up concentration or extermination camps, as they really were. And they rounded all the Jews into ghettos, and they called the occupied areas the General Government. The capital was Krakow, and it was an autonomous entity that was separate from the German government. It was led by a man named Hans Frank, and it was run exclusively by Germans or those of German descent. Now, this area included Poland and the far eastern areas of Germany. And they immediately began persecuting and killing Jews. The methods, the first Jews were machine gunning and firing squads. And they quickly figured out that this was too expensive. They really planned on a mass genocide here. So in 1941, they devised the final solution, which would be a lot faster and a lot less expensive. The first crematorium was operational in Auschwitz in 1940, and I believe it was August, but it wasn't until the summer of 1941 that a product called Zyklon B gas began to use to just expedite this mass murder, this genocide. Now, I'm going to read a paragraph for you about what this is and what it does. Hydrogen cyanide, also known as HCN, is a prussic acid, and it's a chemical compound in the form of a powerfully poisonous, volatile, colorless liquid with the odor of bitter almonds. Now, prussic acid is considered a battlefield poison agent. Its action depends on the restraint of cellular respiration as a result of neutralizing the respiratory enzymes. Prussic acid passes through the mucous membranes and the skin, but principally through the lungs into the blood. It blocks the process by which oxygen is released from red blood corpuscles, and the result is a sort of an internal asphyxiation. This is accompanied by symptoms of injury to the respiratory system, combined with a feeling of fear, dizziness, and vomiting. That's disgusting what they did. Zyklon B was used in Germany before and during the Second World War for disinfection and extermination. That's pest extermination, insects, in the Auschwitz concentration camp. Before they used it to exterminate the Jews, it was used exclusively for sanitation and pest control until, as I said, mid-1941. Now, after the end of August 1941, Zyklon B was used in the camps as an agent of mass annihilation. Now, these extermination camps were killing centers designed to carry out Jewish genocide. Between 41 and 45, the Nazis established 6 extermination camps in the former Polish territory. They were Chełmno, Belzec, Sobibor, Treblinka, Auschwitz-Birkenau, and Majdanek. Chełmno and Auschwitz were established in areas that were annexed to Germany in 1939. The other ones were established in the general government, or let's just call it the general government now, of Poland. Both Auschwitz and Majdanek functioned as concentration and forced labor camps, as well as the killing center. When somebody was unable to work, they killed them. Or if they came into the camp and they had any infirmities and the medical doctors did not want to use them for experimentation, they just killed them. But the overwhelming majority of the victims of the extermination camps were Jews. Some were gypsies and there were some other political prisoners, but the overwhelming majority were Jews. That was Hitler's goal, to exterminate the Jews and other undesirables, primarily Jews, so that he could build the Aryan perfect race, this Nordic ideal that he had in his mind of the perfect race. Now, the estimate is like 3.3 million were killed of Jews were killed in these 6 extermination camps as part of the final solution. The other victims included gypsies and Soviet prisoners of war. This is just the inevitable result of what we call replacement theology. And it still goes on today. It's believed by so many Christians. World War II resulted in a move by the people of the world to bring the Jews back to their land. Now, I said 3.3 million, but that was just in those extermination camps. There were extermination camps in Germany, too, and the total is at least 6 million. Now, through a violent conflict, a Jewish homeland is established. Now, that is a principle we see in Scripture. We saw Ezekiel 20 and Ezekiel 22. As a direct result of the Nazi persecutions on November the 29th, 1947, the United Nations General Assembly voted 33-13. There were 10 abstentions in favor of a partition plan that created the State of Israel. On the same day, the General Assembly of the UN voted with a 2/3 majority to partition Western Palestine into a Jewish and an Arab state. That has to be said because today there doesn't seem to be any recognition of that. Partition Western Palestine into a Jewish and Arab state. Now, about 75% of the land that was allocated to the Jews was just desert. It was desolate. They were desperate to find a haven for the remnants of European Jewry after the Holocaust. And the Jewish population accepted the plan. Now, that accorded them a diminished state. They had something smaller than they wanted, and they had something a lot smaller than was promised to them in the Bible. But they were getting something, and the world sympathy was providing it. The Arabs were intent on preventing any Jewish entity in Palestine, and they rejected it. But not the rest of the world. So on May the 14th, 1948, the last of the British forces left Haifa, and the Jewish agency led by Israel's new prime minister, David Ben-Gurion, declared the creation of the State of Israel in accordance with the United Nations participation, or partition plan. The UN participated in this very strongly, but they came up with this partition plan that was voted on and accepted. Immediately, the United States President Harry Truman recognized the new state. Surprisingly, not too many hours later, the Soviet Premier Joseph Stalin also recognized the new state. Arab League members, Egypt, Transjordan, Syria, Lebanon, and Iraq declared war and announced their rejection of the UN partition decision. Saudi Arabia and Yemen also sent forces. They didn't make a declaration. And they participated in the invasion too. So David Ben-Gurion lived from 1886 to 1973, and he was the State of Israel's first prime minister. He was prime minister from 1948 to 1953, and then from 55 to 63, I believe he was defense minister. He was born David Gruen in Polonsk, Poland, and that was part of Russia at the time. And on October the 16th, 1986, when he was 14, he became one of the founders of the Ezra Youth Movement. He joined the Zionist workers at the age of 17. He was arrested twice during the Russian Revolution, and he settled in the Land of Israel in 1906, first working in orange groves and wine cellars. And as a watchman and farm worker, he became convinced that true Zionism meant settling this land right here, Israel. So in Jerusalem, in 1910, he began writing for the Pole Zion newspaper, and that was called Adut. Now, along with Yitzhak Ben-Zvi and Rachel Yanait, this was the first time he used the word Ben-Gurion. During World War I, actually, he favored Turkey in the adoption of Ottoman citizenship, but the anti-Zionist persecution changed his mind. So he and Rachel were exiled to Egypt in 1915, and he actually went to New York, and he became instrumental in preparing young Jews to come to Palestine right after the war. He married Paula Moonweiss in 1917, and she was an integral part of everything that he did until her death in 1968. After the war, he became general secretary of the Histadrut Labor Federation in 1921. And in 1930, he formed Mapai, which is a Zionist labor party. 1935, he became chairman of the executive committee of the Jewish Agency for Palestine. Now, when Great Britain limited Jewish immigration to Palestine in 1939, there was a decade of Zionist warfare that began. Ben-Gurion was just unrelenting, and he saw the fruition of his efforts, because finally in Tel Aviv on May the 14th, 1948, he proclaimed the independence of the State of Israel. So at 4 o'clock in the afternoon of May the 14th, 1948, the members of what was known then as the Provisional National Council, and was led by Ben-Gurion, met in the Tel Aviv Art Museum, and Ben-Gurion rose and he read the following proclamation. I'm going to read this for you. The land of Israel was the birthplace of the Jewish people. Here, their spiritual, religious, and national identity was formed. Here, they achieved independence and created a culture of national and universal significance. Here they wrote and gave the Bible to the world. Exiled from Palestine, the Jewish people remained faithful to it in all countries of their dispersion, never ceasing to pray and hope for their return and the restoration of their national freedom. According, we, the members of the National Council representing the Jewish people in Palestine and the Zionist movement of the world, met together in solemn assembly today, the day of the termination of the British mandate of Palestine by virtue of the natural and historic right of the Jewish people and the resolution of the General Assembly of the United Nations. Hereby proclaim the establishment of the Jewish state in Palestine to be called Israel. With trust in Almighty God, we set our hand to this declaration at this session of the Provisional State Council in the city of Tel Aviv on this Sabbath Eve, the fifth day of Iyar 5708, the 14th day of May 1948. Yeah, at the time he did this, the British were still governing Israel, and they refused to implement this partition plan that the United Nations had established. The British government made it really clear it was going to do everything in its power to prevent the birth of the Jewish state. What a change from just 25 years or so ago when the British government wanted to do something. But immediately after the UN Assembly decision, the Arabs launched their preliminary onslaught on the Jewish community. The British army gave the Palestinian Arabs cover and aid, and it resulted in a whole host of terrible things. One, obstruction of Jewish defenses on the ground. There was a blocking movement of Jewish reinforcements and supplies to outlying settlements, opening the land frontiers for the entry of Arab soldiers from the neighboring Arab states. This is unbelievable. This is what the Brits did. They maintained a blockade in the Mediterranean, and they were sealing the coast and the ports through which alone the outnumbered Jews could expect reinforcements. It's amazing. Handing over arms dumps to the Arabs. They were sending in forces from Malta to bomb and shell the Jewish force when Jaffa was on the point of falling to the Jewish counterattack. Now, continuing to supply the Arab states, they were preparing to invade across the borders with all that they asked for, and they weren't making any secret of this either. It's unbelievable. In 1948, after the UN voted to give Israel statehood, these five Arab armies, Egypt, Syria, Transjordan, Lebanon, Iraq, immediately invaded Israel. And the stated purpose was to push the Jews into the sea. In other words, genocide. Now, there was a man named Hassan Pasha. He was Secretary General of the Arab League, and he publicly declared their intentions. He says, this will be a war of extermination and a momentous massacre, which will be spoken of like the Mongolian massacres and the Crusades. What Hitler didn't finish 3 years earlier, the Arabs will finish once and for all. My goodness. It was a Nazi collaborator, Haj Amin al-Husseini. Now, he led the Arabs of the former British Mandate of Palestine, and he was charged at the Nuremberg trials before escaping in 1941. Now, al-Husseini actively supported Hitler's policy to exterminate the Jews in World War II. The forces against the Jews were extremely strong. But despite the advantages in numbers, organization, and weapons, the Jews began to take the initiative in the weeks from April 1st until the Declaration of Independence on May the 14th. The Haganah, the Jewish forces, captured several major towns, including Tiberias and Haifa, and they temporarily opened the road to Jerusalem. Czechoslovakia was the only country willing to provide the Jews with weapons. Now, they gave the Jews used World War I weapons, but because God wanted them to survive, he allowed them to capture territory from which the Arab aggressors attacked. Jordan captured what's called now the West Bank, but that's not a very nice word because the true Jewish names are Judea and Samaria. And this includes the Jewish eastern half of Jerusalem, which they called the Arab East Jerusalem. Now, Egypt captured what was now known as the Gaza Strip. And that was in the ancient times, the land of the Philistines. But both countries murdered or expelled every Jew who was living there at the time. You know, during the 19 years of Jordan and Egypt occupied those territories, they called them the occupied territories, neither country was willing to create independent states for the remaining Arabs. And they started to call these people Palestinians. They were residing in those territories. Instead, those regions were plundered and allowed to rot. The Jewish graves were desecrated. The gravestones were used to pave roads and build latrines. And the Jewish homes were given to the Arabs. Most of these Jewish refugees moved into Israel. And in just a few years, doubled Israel's population. The Ashkenazi Jews of Israel, they absorbed Arab-speaking brethren into their society. By comparison, displaced Arabs who wanted to go into the neighboring Arab countries weren't allowed in. The Arabs would not take anybody in. So they stayed in these refugee camps, and they remained there and are still there now. That's the reason that this group called the Palestinians is so angry and upset. They're angry at Israel, but really, it's the Arab countries that wouldn't let them in from Israel after 1948. It's a plan to create a pressure cooker in Israel with these so-called Palestinians and have them attack the Jews in frustration for being in these internment camps. In 1949, Israel signed armistice agreements with Egypt, Syria, Lebanon, and Transjordan. And at that time, Transjordan changed their name to Jordan. Israel won the war for independence against all odds. Now, at this time, Jordan annexed Judea and Samaria. Only Britain and Pakistan recognized this annexation as legitimate. The region became a source of many terrorist attacks against Israel citizens. You know, back in 1945, there were about 870,000 Jews living in the surrounding Arab countries. The Muslims called them Dehmini. Dehmini. During 1947 and 1948, the Arabs persecuted these Jews. Their personal and their real property were confiscated. Yemen, Egypt, Libya, Syria, and Iraq had anti-Jewish riots. And Zionism was even declared to be a capital crime in Iraq. There were about 600,000 Jewish refugees that were left in Arab states, and they were welcomed into Israel by the Ashkenazi Jews living there at the time. Now, the Jews became full citizens of Israel. But due to the wishes of these Arab leaders, the Arabs in Israel did not become citizens, but remained in these internment camps and remained refugees. It's crazy. The Arabs would not let their brethren in from Israel. They wanted to keep them there and just create a problem. You know, having lost the battle, the Palestinian Arab terrorist groups called the Fedayeen began systematic raids against the Israeli civilian population. 1,300 Israelis were killed and wounded by Arab terrorists between 1949 and 1956. And the Fedayeen operated from bases located in and controlled by Egypt, Lebanon, and Jordan. On May the 15th, 1967, the then president of Egypt, Gamal Nasser, ordered a blockade of the Strait of Tehran. Now, that blockade cut off Israel's southern access to the Red Sea and beyond. Now, by May the 31st of 1967, Egypt had moved 100,000 troops, 1,000 tanks, and 500 heavy guns into the Sinai. By June the 4th, Arab forces outnumbered Israel 3-1 as they poised on Israel's borders for a war. Now, this was the beginning of what became known as Israel's Six-Day War. It was fought on three fronts against three countries in three overlapping stages. In the south, Israel engaged and defeated the Egyptians. In the central region, Israel engaged and defeated the Jordanians. And in the north, the same thing happened. Israel defeated the Syrians. Now, in each of these three theaters, Israel gained a lot of territory that would serve as its own buffers in the future years. On the morning of June the 5th, 1967, the Israeli Air Force destroyed almost the entire Egyptian Air Force. There was more than 300 planes, and they did this in less than 3 hours. Israel's armored divisions, under the leadership of General Ariel Sharon, also launched a lightning attack on the same day, and he was successful because more than 800 Egyptian tanks were destroyed and thousands of soldiers were taken as prisoners of war. Nasser later acknowledged that 80% of Egypt's Russian-supplied military equipment had been lost in the Sinai debacle. And finally, at 8 p.m. on June the 8th, Nasser gave up. He accepted a ceasefire. The Jews again won against all odds. It's important to remember at this point in our story that Russia was supplying the Arab nations. Russia was supplying the Arab nations. Even though Stalin had recognized Israel as a state, he was still sending arms over to the Arab countries. Now, from 1948 to 1967, Jerusalem was a divided city. The Arab Legion of Jordan had occupied East Jerusalem, including the Old City, since 1948, since the War of Independence. The Jordanian troops had decimated the Jewish quarter of the Old City, and they blew up its synagogues, and they were just destroying every vestige of Jewish life there. But during the initial battles with Egypt, Israel actually notified King Hussein that it had no intention of attacking his country. Hussein, the Jordanian president, actually believed Nasser's lies, and he joined the Arabs. When the Arab League started to shell Western Jerusalem, the Israelis swiftly counterattacked and were very successful. Paratroopers launched an attack from the Mount of Olives. Now, listen to this. These paratroopers launched this attack from the Mount of Olives because they landed there and they entered Jerusalem through the Lion Gate on the east side. Now, Israel was careful to minimize the use of artillery, which could have made the attack a whole lot easier with a less loss of life. And this was done out of respect for a number of holy sites within the ancient walls of the city. By June the 8th, the Israeli troops were gazing at Herod's stones of the western wall of the old temple, of what's left of the old temple. Now, although Jerusalem was a central prize, Israel also captured, in those four fierce days of fighting, biblical Judea and Samaria. As I said, they're calling that the West Bank. The Jews don't call it the West Bank. It's Judea and Samaria. These are not only the sites of biblical Jerusalem, but also the ancient towns of Shechem, Shiloh, Bethel, Bethlehem, and Hebron. Now, Egypt's ally in the north was Syria. From their heavily fortified bunkers and miles of trenches along the Golan Heights, the Syrian gunners had to harass the Jewish farmers and the fishermen of the Hula Valley and the Sea of Galilee for about 19 years. The problem for the Israelis was that the Syrians literally held the high ground, and their Russian sponsors helped them to fortify it really well. Now, Syria was threatening Israel's destruction. The army saw an opportunity to end the threat to the citizens that lived in the north. I don't mean the Syrian army, I mean the Israeli army. And they thought they could get this done now once and for all. And that's where the Golan Heights is. But the battle for the Golan was different. This wasn't a desert, not like the Sinai, where the tanks could easily maneuver. The Syrians, though, had planted numerous mines just slightly under the sand so that the Israelis couldn't see them and would step on these, and they would be killed. Now, the Air Force prepared the way for landing paratroopers behind the Syrian lines, and the Israeli bulldozers were able to clear the way so the armored units could batter the Syrian troops and drive them deep into the Golan. Syria lost and accepted a ceasefire on June the 10th, 1967. And again, the Israelis won against all odds. It is just an amazing story, an amazing story. It was an amazing military victory. This six-day war, though, left more than 700 Israelis dead and more than 2,500 wounded. You know, the figures were never officially released by the Arabs, but the casualties were conservatively estimated at about 15,000. The Six-Day War established Israel as a major military power. And interestingly, the Arabs began to fight in the world liberal press and call them occupiers. Seems like the world press had forgotten that they were given this land by the United Nations. Now, this has been a burden that's been really hard to bear because it exists today. Israel eventually returned the Sinai to Egypt, 1973, when Egyptian President Sadat acknowledged the Jews' legitimate existence, and then he got assassinated for doing that, didn't he? Now, Israel remains in control of the Golan Heights, and it's unwilling to see it return to a group of bunkers and military positions. They don't want to have that military presence up there. On the other hand, Israel is under a great pressure to return most of the West Bank. They have not done. Now, those areas of biblical Judea and Samaria are not going to go back to any Arab nation. Israel does not trust the Palestinians to actually control or legitimately operate any Palestinian state. They have just a horrible, murderous record of terrorism. So they're not going to deal with them unless they absolutely have to. In March of 1969, they were still humiliated by the 67 defeat. Egypt launched a war, what's been called a war of attrition, against Israeli forces in the Sinai. With intense artillery fire against Israel's, called the Bar Lev line, that's on the east bank of the Suez Canal. And after large losses in May, June, and July of 69, Israel responded with air raids into Egypt. Nasser, in response, appealed to the Soviet Union for aid. And on March the 19th, 1970, Soviet missile batteries were installed in Egypt near the canal. Moscow, who'd been supplying weapons to him, also participated in the war effort, operating weapons for the Egyptians. there was intense pressure from the United States to lead to a ceasefire, which occurred on August the 7th, 1970. And there were plans to put into effect the United States' plan for peace in the region based on this crazy concept called land for peace. But the ceasefire, which called for a freeze on the situation in the canal, that means there was no movement, either troops or military equipment, was immediately breached by Egypt's movement forward of forces on the same day it came into effect. So they didn't do what they agreed to do and almost immediately violated it. Israel responded by just suspending her participation in the negotiations until the situation, which had prevailed on the eve of the signing of the ceasefire agreement, was restored. The peace plan was never implemented. None of these so-called peace plans have ever been implemented because the Arabs lie about them and then violate what it is that they've agreed to. You know, in an effort to force Israel to surrender captured lands, Israel and Syria jointly attacked Israel on October the 6th, 1973, on their highest holy day, Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. The other Muslim states contributed troops and financial support, but it was only these two, Egypt and Syria, that actually came at them. The Israeli forces were caught by surprise, and they suffered huge losses in terms of equipment and human life. Now, following an Egyptian refusal to accept a ceasefire and a Soviet airlift to the Muslim states, the United States sent an airlift to an Israel. That enabled the recovery from some of these earlier setbacks. And one confirmed miraculous story that demonstrates the providential nature of the Jewish victory needs to be discussed here. This is fascinating. During the Yom Kippur War, a troop of Israeli soldiers found themselves in an area riddled with hundreds of Syrian-placed landmines. When they discovered this, they quickly got on the ground, and they very slowly started pushing their bayonets into the ground so that they could identify the location of these mines. Then they began this arduously slow and dangerous track. They're just uncovering and unarming these mines. It was a terrible process, and it was so slow. They had no idea how many there were or even exactly where they were. They just found themselves in the middle of this minefield, afraid to move. And believe this or not, suddenly a strong desert wind came up out of nowhere, and the clouds in the sky clear and exposed the shining moon. It was very bright. The wind stopped just as suddenly as it started. When it was over, the soldiers discovered that all the landmines were exposed and they were brightly illuminated by the moon. So they were able to walk around them and safely leave the minefield, and they successfully completed their mission. Israel won this war too. It was, just like the other ones, against all odds. You know, after the Jewish victory, Saudi Arabia in retaliation, I mean, they retaliated, and they led the Arab world on an oil embargo that they imposed on the United States and some other Western nations. Now, this method of waging war is becoming a new strategy for Israel's enemies to attack them. In the years following the 1973 war, though, Israel's enemies realized, man, we can't beat them on the battlefield. Winston Churchill realized this a long time ago, and he wrote of the Jews' military superiority when he was a prime minister of Britain. And he wrote a memo to General Ismay on January the 25th, 1944. That was before statehood, talking about nobody's going to beat these guys militarily. So they turned to diplomatic warfare, and they tried to weaken Israel's international diplomatic position. Now, there's a lot of pressure from the Muslim world, mostly African and third world countries, but they broke diplomatic relations with Israel. And in 1975, the Soviet Muslim Third World Bloc at the United Nations succeeded in passing what ultimately became infamously known as Zionism equals racism General Assembly Resolution. Now, racism has been used in political correctness to malign different groups, and it seems to work. This was an attempt to delegitimize the rights of the Jewish people to return to their own ancestral homeland. Now, this resolution was not revoked until December of 1991. It's incredible. It's incredible. Now, I've mentioned S.A.A. Maudi in previous messages, and it's helpful to understand what he wrote in a paper called Jihad in Islam in 1991. And what he said was real simple. Islam wishes to destroy all states and governments anywhere on the face of the earth, which are opposed to the ideology and program of Islam. Islam requires the earth, not just a portion, but the whole planet, and that God's law, they know as Sharia, should be enforced in the world by force of arms. Truth cannot be confined within geographical borders. The allegiance of a Muslim does not rest on his domicile in the country which is his, but on the faith to which he belongs. Wherever there is the rule of Islam, there is his own country. And that needs to be understood in light of the activities of those who follow Islam today. Now, in conclusion of this series, we saw that World War I helped the Zionist movement, and it transformed the possibility and a desire for a Jewish state from just theoretical discussions into a real possibility, especially with the practical Zionist under Chaim Weizmann. And then World War I, there was the elimination of Turkey, which was the home of the last Islamic caliphate. It also let the Jews realize that the return to their homeland was going to be through a bloody conflict. Turkey was a traditional British ally, and keeping its allies and colonies was very, very important to the British. And that all ended when Turkey joined Germany in World War I. So that split the Brits off from Turkey, and British Prime Minister H.H. Asquith said in November 1914, the Turkish Empire has committed suicide. So when the Turks switched its alignment from Britain to Germany, Britain's goal was the defeat of the Ottoman Turks and their empire in the Middle East. This led to the establishment of the Jewish state. It also set forth the notion that this new notion, well, there should be an Arab state as well. And this initiated this concept that became known as Arab nationalism. You know, Theodore Herzl's early efforts at describing and writing and talking and the theoretical things that he did had given the Jews a 20-year head start over the Arabs in getting a homeland. Even before World War I began, the Zionist leaders had been in touch with leading British policymakers. They discussed the possibilities the war would give them for having their own sovereign land. And that was Chaim Weizmann. We saw that. World War I also introduced a significant amount of violence and extremism into the world. Now, this was an omen for the future of Israel. There was now no possibility of the Jews peacefully integrating back into the Middle East with the Arabs. There was an Arab revolt in 1936, And that was encouraged and rewarded by the British, who had supported local Arab leaders. The British had been drilling for oil in the Arab countries for more than 30 years, and they didn't want to lose the inexpensive oil they took from there. This caused them to play both sides in the struggle. Interestingly, what had driven out the Turks and created the new Arab states could also be employed in due course to root out the Jews. This, the Arabs learned from the British, so that in time, both within Palestine and across the Middle East as a whole, the Arab leaders faced with the choice of negotiation or war, choose war. And they invariably lost. They kept choosing war and they kept losing. Now, in the wake of the war, the extremist regime seized power and ruled by force and terror, first in Russia, then in Italy, and finally in Germany. And the transformation of Germany from the best-educated society in Europe to a totalitarian race state was a bad omen for the Jews. You know, the anti-Semites of Central Europe had always treated the Jews with a variety of degrees of cruelty and injustice, up to and including murderous pogroms and expulsion. It was only Hitler that actually started exterminating them. The outbreak of World War II provided a charade, if you will, that allowed Hitler to implement an industrial-grade systematic genocide of the Jews. The Holocaust destroyed one-third of the world's Jews, but it also united much of the rest of the world's Jewry behind the Zionist project. And it even brought into existence the American Jewish lobby, which was the prototype of all the great lobbies later on in the 20th century. Since the Holocaust, it became clear that Zion had to be not merely a national home, but a refuge and a fortress. And the Holocaust spurred the Jews and the refugees to join them to create the military means to defend themselves. And they said, never again. You know, if World War I created the new Zion, it was World War II that made the Israeli army and the restored national homeland possible. Finally, it's very clear that the Bible promises have been and are being realized regarding the covenants and the prophecies. The national Israel, the nation Israel, is back in the land. They fought several major military conflicts, and they won each one against all odds. They are there in the national unbelief regarding Jesus, Yeshua, as their Messiah. Now, they're there following the judgment, which is the Holocaust, and they are going to be there until judgment, the Great Tribulation, exactly as God said through Ezekiel, Isaiah, and Zechariah. Divine providence returned them to the land, and it doesn't matter what their enemies or their naysayers claim. They're back in the land, and they're victorious. A clear acceptance of the scriptures as they were intended to be read make it easy to see God's hand in the struggles that the Israelites had to achieve a homeland. The wars that Israel won in 48, 67, and 73 are only explainable through divine providence. You know, it's further very appropriate to see that Bible believers that do not see Israel's presence in the land as prophesied are just not biblically grounded. Biblical believers that do not see Israel's presence in the land as biblically appropriate don't know the Bible very well. Believers that are biblically ignorant are never going to see God's divine plan and providence in protecting the nation Israel. They just look at this as an accident of history. But they will teach the sovereignty of God and how he controls everything. I don't know how that works in their mind, how they divide this out so crazily. But a common excuse for introducing these aberrant interpretations of Bible passages of prophecy says, well, it depends on how you view certain passages in Scripture. Readers don't decide the author's intent, and they're obligated to use normal reading skills, correct understanding of the language, basic grammar, to interpret what the author's written. God said the Jews would be back in their promised land following judgment, and they have been. He said they would receive judgment yet to come, and it will happen during the Great Tribulation. Christ told them that life would be difficult for them because they rejected him, and it's going to remain that way until they accept Jesus as their Messiah. Now the land is theirs. Nobody's going to take it away because the great God of the universe has ordained it. And I say, even so, come, Lord Jesus.